Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. Her name is Chris, and her home group is Bloomsbury. She's out of Stuartsville. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you, Chris.
Water the clock? Okay. First, I want to thank Jeff and Dave for asking me here, and all of you, really, for having me here tonight. It's an honor to be asked to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have a lot of respect for this group, so it was really an honor to be asked to come here, so thank you for that. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since August 9th, 1992, celebrated 19 years of sobriety this past summer, and it's a miracle. I'm still amazed by that. My home group is the Bloomsbury Believers in Bloomsbury, New Jersey, and it's the best home group in AA. And if you don't feel that way about your home group, don't come to mine and screw it up. Stay in yours and be part of the solution. I'm just kidding. We'd love to have you. We got a Friday night speaker with a beginner's meeting in the back and a great step meeting on Tuesday, and we'd love to have you over there. I am sponsored. My sponsor has a sponsor, and I know the lineage pretty well. My sponsor lives in Daytona Beach, Florida. She sponsors me long distance, but that works for us. So she's awesome, and I'm very grateful to have her. So I'm going to try to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I was driving over here, and I did my prayers, as Jeff and I discussed, and went in the bathroom real quick, like we discussed, and because I know when I'm rehearsing, I'm trying to be something for you guys, and I don't need to do that. So I grew up in New Jersey. I grew up in what I fondly kind of think of as a good white trash town in Middlesex County. Very blue-collar, very full of kids, and it was a really great neighborhood to grow up in. I really identify with Sandy Beach is one of my favorite speakers. If I could be a Sandy Beach groupie and just follow him around, I would. I love him, and when he talks about how the longer I'm sober, the better my childhood gets, I totally identify with that. I totally identify with that, because I know when I got here, I was very negative in many ways, and all I seemed to be able to remember was the bad parts, but it wasn't. It wasn't. Very blue collar. My dad was an alcoholic. He was the alcoholic variety that was really unpredictable, and so the house could be chaotic at times. But I lived in the kind of neighborhood where, you know, everybody knew everybody. I knew who lived in every single house on my block, on the block behind me, and on the other side. And you know, the lady across the street would yell at me just as sure as my mother would. Jack us up. I mean, that's kind of how it was. But she'd make me a sandwich if I was hungry, too. And it was kind of like takes a village type of neighborhood. And there's a lot to be said for that. I grew up there, and I stayed there my whole until I left at 19. But my dad's alcoholism, he would sometimes come home at 2 o'clock in the morning and get us all out of bed because he wanted to sing songs and play the spoons and have a good old time. And other times he would come home and get us all out of bed because there's toys in the yard, and we're all going to clean it up. And he's in a rage, and he's throwing dishes. He would hold the big gray garbage can out of the yard and smash all my mother's dishes. And you just never knew what you're going to get when he came in the door, and there was a lot of fear around that. But my dad did have 1 year of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember it. I remember it being very different during that time when he wasn't drinking. And I also remember him celebrating 1 year of sobriety by getting drunk on right around New Year's Eve, and that was kind of the end of that. But my first introduction to 12-step programs was really by my dad going to AA, because apparently the hospital had AA and Al-Anon and Alateen all at the same time, I think on a Saturday night, and the whole family would go down there. I have three siblings, and we would all go and go to our meetings, and I remember me and my siblings, none of us said anything. We did not say anything in that meeting. I don't remember going there too much. I think at some point we were just saying, we don't want to do this anymore. So, I mean, that was kind of an opportunity, but I remember being very distrustful and not wanting to talk to anybody about anything that was going on in my house. That was the culture of the family. The neighbors knew, but, you know, nobody outside really knew what was going on. And I had my first drink that I remember around the age of 7. on a holiday with the family around the dining room table, all the good china out and everything, and it was, and I had a little stemmed crystal shot glass that was very delicate and pretty with Manischewitz wine in it, and all the kids got it. And I know a lot of families give their kids a little bit of wine at the holidays, and it's not necessarily dysfunctional, but I believe I was born an alcoholic. I don't want to debate that with anybody. It happens to be what I believe, and I remember that drink. I remember that first drink. I remember it tasted awful. It was thick and sweet, and it burned, but I quickly liked that burning. I could feel it traveling through me and just kind of going out to my fingertips, and I remember, like, pow. I remember that. I don't remember my first milkshake. I don't remember my first ice cream cone. I don't remember my first hot dog. I remember my first drink. I'm pretty sure I'm an alcoholic from the time I was born. And the other thing that kind of supports that theory is that whole square peg in a round hole. I always felt that way. And I've talked to my siblings about how I felt as a child, and none of them felt that way. But I did, and I don't know why. Mental twists, emotional twists, insecurity, inferiority for no apparent reason. This was just how I walked around. And so when I got drunk the first time, consciously set out to get drunk at the age of 12, I remember that very well, too. I started drinking. You know, I hung around with a lot of older people, as a lot of us seem to do, and was with some people at 12 who were able to get alcohol. And I remember I seemed to be drinking faster than everyone else. I was already being criticized for taking more than my share. I definitely had that urgency. And all the wonderful things that we hear in these rooms that happened to me. You know, all that stuff fell away, and I didn't know it was possible to feel that way, that it was possible to feel, like, kind of normal. I was like, oh, my God, this might be normal, you know. All that crap fell away. And the way I think of it to this day is almost like I can see, like, these gears in my mind, and they're all kind of not lined up correctly. And when I took that first drink, everything kind of went psh. They fell right in place, and the gears started to turn. Alcohol was just it, man. It fixed everything, and I was okay. Why wouldn't I keep doing that? You know, I mean, I threw up. I felt horrible the next day. I don't know if I blacked out the very first time, but I immediately started blacking out from the age of 12. I was thinking earlier today about how I drank from 12 to 27, so it was 15 years. Which may not be much, but it was enough for me. And I remember when I had 15 years of sobriety thinking, oh, you know, I've been sober as long as I drank, you know, and now somehow this was going to be some sort of equalizer was going to fall into place now, you know, and it was just another day. There was nothing different about it. But you know, it's kind of a typical story. It's not all that interesting. I drank as much as I could, whenever I could, with all the older people. We had our neighborhood dead-ended at the woods, where we had woods and fields and train tracks and a ravine that ran through it. And when we were kids, we played army in those woods. And when I started drinking, we started partying in those woods. Our little forts on the ground when I was little became forts up in the trees so we could, you know, see the cops coming. And we had a couple of those in different locations. And immediately I started to lose friends, getting electrocuted on the tracks, getting hit by trains, just alcohol poisoning, you know. I mean, that started. I remember my next-door neighbor died. He was like 80-something. I mean, he was an old guy, and he died, and it was the first funeral I went to. And then it seemed like I just never stopped going to funerals. You know, my neighborhood, we had a lot of death and a lot of addiction and stuff in my neighborhood. But anyway, it all seemed very normal to me, and there was no way I was going to stop doing it because I was having a good old time. when I was 15, my father was killed. And, you know, I said we came from this blue-collar family, four kids, all like a year apart. You know, we were kind of a clan, actually. And so when my dad died, it was really devastating to the family, especially to my mother. But I remember I had a party to go to that night, and I was home getting ready to go to the party. It was a Friday night, and somebody came to the door, and said that this man had been murdered out on the highway, and they thought it was my dad. They weren't sure, and they took my mother away to go check it out. And eventually they came back, and yeah, it was my dad, and he was gone. And my first thought was, should I still go to the party? I really still want to go to the party. So I tell you that story so that you can know that, you know, the depths of my selfishness was already well developed at the age of 15. You know, selfish, self-centered, self-seeking. You know, I mean, I think myself kind of a nice person and stuff, but when I'm honest about how I was when it came to my alcohol, that was a really sad, sick thought. But that was the truth of where I was at. And I drank my way through his funeral, and I remember standing at the front of the funeral parlor, staring at his body, open casket, trying to make myself cry because I knew that's what everybody expected me to do. But I was numb already. I definitely mixed in some non-conference to prove things, and that helped me along the way there. But I just drank as much as I could drink, and I hurt my mom during those years too. You know, she had enough to deal with without me running crazy and going out and not coming home and lying about where I was and disappearing for days at a time. When I was 16, 17, I would do that. And so, I mean, it was all kind of typical. And I did manage to get through high school. After my dad died, two of us went back, two of us didn't, and I managed to get through that. And was a daily drinker by 18, daily drinker. And really pathetic. It's so funny. When I made an amends to my mom about maybe 4 months ago of something that I remember. You know, I celebrated 19 years of sobriety, and I just remembered something that I needed to go back and make amends for. So I guess, you know, more will be revealed is the best motto for this program. You know, it's just when we're ready, we remember this stuff. But I was 18 years old. I was a daily drinker. I remember I was home one night in my room, and I didn't have any money. I didn't have any alcohol, and I didn't have any cigarettes. And I went looking. I found a bottle of really nice wine that my mom had hidden away in the kitchen. And I found some Tipperillo cigars in my brother's bedroom. And I went back to my room, and I drank this wine and smoked my brother's cigars. And I remember you know how late at night, a lot of times, I don't know if they still do, but 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, they run those infomercials to adopt children overseas, and they have all these terrible stuff. I adopted one of those, which I totally forgot about until it showed up in the mail. You know, I was all drunk and crying with my cigar, you know. Poor babies, you know. Poor babies. So anyway, I forgot all about that and made amends to my mom, and I tracked down that bottle of wine. It was kind of hard to find, but I tracked it down, and I bought her I bought her 4 bottles of it to try to make up for how long it took me to get back to her. And I got my brother a really good fat cigar, and something happened a couple months ago as a holiday or something, and I was able to make amends to them. But it opened up a whole can of worms with my mother. but anyway, so basically I'm 18 years old. I'm a daily drinker. I got a car that my mom was blessed to have given to me by my mom. She wanted me to go to college. I wanted to drink, so I didn't go to college, and I went to work. And I always worked from the time I was like 15. I started working. and so I'm working in the shoe department at Caldor's because I actually crashed my car driving home drunk from a bar, and I can walk to Caldor's. I had been working for a really nice photography firm, and they really liked me, and it was a fun job. But I crashed my car, so now I'm in the shoe department at Caldor's. And I'm just waiting for somebody to come and save me because I have no idea what I'm doing with this life of mine. My brothers and sisters are moving on. My brother's a journeyman in the union, and my sister went to pursued a legal degree. And my other brother was working for New Jersey Transit. Everybody was moving on, doing well, and I was still at home doing my thing. And so my girlfriend called me up and asked me if I wanted to go on a blind date. And so I said, sure, you know. I got nothing going on. I got no car. I got paid. I want to party. So she had a friend, her boyfriend's friend from Virginia. He was in the Navy, and he just bought a new Harley, and he lived down in Virginia, and he wanted to put some mileage on his bike and take a nice ride. So he was coming up to Jersey to visit his friends. So they hooked me up on a blind date, and I'll never forget when he pulled up in front of my house on that bike. And We always used to joke. I had a T-shirt on that said "Evil, Wicked, Mean, and Nasty," and he just thought I was fabulous, you know. And I thought he was pretty fabulous too. He had a really, really nice bike, and he was a really cool dude. And my blind date lasted 3 days, and he drank like I did, and we had a really good time. And he went back down to Virginia and started writing me these love letters every day. I mean, this is the guy of my dreams. He's writing me love letters, sending me stuffed animals. You know, he was great. And so I packed up and I moved down to Virginia. And I lived with him and three other guys. He was in the Navy, and I lived with him and three other sailors. And I was like the little house mom. Yeah, it was fun. I was 19 years old. I was having a ball. So I got a job in a bar, of course. I lied about whatever experience I told them I had, and they hired me. And I was a lot younger and a lot thinner, and they were really happy with me. And I ran around in my high-heeled shoes and my short shorts with all the sailors and the bikers who were my clientele, and I made a ton of money, and I got in a lot of trouble. And but, you know, they all thought I was great, you know. I would go to the bar and work, and then I wasn't allowed to drink till I got off of work, and I usually honored that. And then we had this after-hours club we would all go to and drink until the sun came up, and then I'd go home and sleep a little bit, get up, clean the house, make some dinner for the boys, and go off to work again. And that was my schedule every day. And but I did what I always did, which was get in trouble, you know, sleeping with the bartender. And you know, when I came into this program and I heard about the phenomenon of craving, you know, that thing when we start drinking and something kicks in and we just can't stop in spite of consequences, anything, nothing, you know, that phenomenon of craving that I can't stop, you know, I had that from a very young age. And so, of course, I was getting in a lot of trouble. I had a lot of good intentions towards the end when I tried to stop drinking. But at that time, I didn't care. I was having a good old time. You know, there was plenty of booze. I didn't have to worry about running out. And I had a good old time. But, you know, I got in trouble, and I got caught with the bartender by my boyfriend. And I had to quit my job. And he got out of the Navy, and we ended up coming back to New Jersey, getting pregnant, getting married in that order. And you know, I just allowed life to happen to me. You know, I didn't have any goals. I didn't have any plans. You know, I didn't really think there was any problem with drinking and drugging and having a good old time. I thought I was living the life, you know, and I had this guy that saved me, and he's going to take care of me. He bought me a car when I got down to Virginia. You know, whatever I needed, he was giving it to me. And he was drinking like me. Many times on the back of that motorcycle where he would fall asleep. Talk about powerlessness. That was scary. On the Virginia Beach Boulevard at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he's sleeping, and I'm on the back. I woke him up more than once. But, you know, so we were living the crazy life, but we came back and we got pregnant, we got married, and we really kind of thought that we'd make a shot at being normal. And alcoholism doesn't allow that to happen, you know? I mean, we were not heavy drinkers, we were alcoholics. And I tried, I really did. When I found out I was pregnant for the first time with my son, I stopped drinking. And when I got pregnant the second time with my daughter, well, I'll stop drinking. But my disease had progressed after a couple years, and I didn't realize how hard it was going to be. And I didn't stop drinking. And I had a lot of denial about that for a while when I came in here. My sister told me in early sobriety that she remembers me. We shared a house at one point when I was pregnant with my daughter, and she remembers me coming downstairs at 10 o'clock in the morning with my belly out to here, cracking a Budweiser. I don't remember that, but I'm sure she's right, you know. I almost feel like I need to stop and give you a disclaimer now, because everything I'm telling you is my perception of what happened. You know, it is what it is. I've talked to my siblings a lot about things that went on when we were growing up, and some things they remember totally different. I do not have a good chronological memory of things that happened. I remember a lot of things that happened, but I could have been 8, I could have been 12, I could have been 5, I could have been 8. I never knew. I can't remember things in order. I think I did some brain damage to myself out there. But so anyway, more of the same. You know, we're both doing this deal. Well, what happened was my husband got in some trouble with some other things. And he decided to go to treatment. He was ending up in the hospital, in the psych ward. He was seeing a counselor, and eventually they determined that maybe, you know, he needed to go to treatment. Now, he was out of the house by then because we had this woman that moved in next door from California, and he decided he liked her better than me, so he moved out to be with her. So when I think about my drinking at the end, he was gone. I don't know where he was. He was only like one town away, but I never saw him. Every now and then he would show up, and he would come in the door, and he would talk to me. And I'm sure that he thought he was talking to me, that he was making sense. What was coming out of his mouth was like backwards, inside-out words. He made no sense at all. At one point, he didn't sleep for over 10 days, and he ended up in the psych ward, and then he went to treatment. So there was a lot of pain at that time that we were hitting bottom, and he left me for this woman. And I was no angel either. I mean, neither one of us behaved like married people. I don't want to act like he all hurt me and I was all good, because I wasn't. And so it was a very painful, ugly time. And we had a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old at this time now. I can't go anywhere without a 6-pack of Budweiser in my diaper bag. I cannot function at all without drinking and having alcohol with me at all times. And so he left and went off to treatment, and I had this pattern of behavior where I would get up in the morning and I would clean up the kids and feed them and try to, you know, do the mom thing and get them off to preschool. There was a preschool down the street that they went to. And then I would start drinking. And then I would get the kids to the babysitter, and I would go to the bar, and I would work, restaurant, it was waiting tables, and I would work until we closed, and then I would get drunk again. I was like getting drunk twice a day, and that was just how I was getting through it all and dealing with it all. And what started happening, which scared the heck out of me, first of all, I remember the first day I couldn't brush my teeth without cracking a beer and drinking it. That was scary to me, that I was shaking so much. Somehow I figured out that maybe a beer would, I don't know if I knew a beer would stop the shaking, but I didn't like the way it felt. I'm uncomfortable, so I drink. That, you know, I don't want to feel anything, so I drink. And but what started happening was I started having this demon man that came into my room in the middle of the night, and I had a king-size water bed, and I was sleeping in it by myself, and I used to sleep like right on the rail, right on the edge. And he would come, and he would sit on my feet, and the bed would rock, and he would wake me up. And he never said anything. He would just sit there. And that scared the hell out of me. And I said, one eye, oh, God, he's here again. Sometimes there were, like, full-blown loud parties going on in my living room. That would wake me up. You know, like the classic kind of tinkling of glasses, people laughing, music, talking. This obviously was not actually happening, but I would hear these parties going on in my living room, and I had this guy sitting on the bed. I who thinks I'm so slick, I had no idea if I got up and took a drink in the middle of the night that this guy would leave. I had no idea if I kept some booze next to the bed, I could probably keep him from showing up, because I didn't know anything about DTs or any of that stuff. I had an uncle who was paranoid, schizophrenic, alcoholic, drug addict with an epileptic disorder. He was really funny. And he used to see things, and he used to hear things, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm nuts. You know, he was quite normal until he was in his 20s, and then his schizophrenic got kicked up, and that was it. And I really thought that that's what it was, that I'm going nuts. I had no idea that I could take care of this. So hang in there. I'm going to get sober in a minute. So he had gone off to treatment, and I'm here doing my drunk twice a day, demon on the bed, parties in the living room, the kids. I really tried to keep them clean and fed, but I was not being a mother to these kids. And truth be told, they should have been taken away. I didn't have him, and I didn't have any of his money. So there were times when I left those kids in the bed by themselves sleeping, and I went down to the bar because I needed something. And I knew if I walked into the Stopover Bar in Hampton, somebody would buy me a drink. And they also sold packaged goods until they closed at 2 o'clock in the morning, so it was a great spot for me. And, you know, I left those kids home alone. And I guess God watched over them because I never got caught and nothing ever bad happened. But that was a big part of why I was willing to go to treatment. My husband went to a short-term 28-day program, and then they sent him to a halfway house down in Delaware. And then the 28-day treatment program started to call me every day. Steve's doing good. We're worried about you. What are you going to do about your drinking? You know, and I was very angry about that. I didn't appreciate him sicking these people on me. But I also just felt like such a piece of crap by then. You know, I was just living this horrible life, and I had these beautiful, wonderful kids that I was not doing right by. And so it was really the kids that I went to treatment for. I didn't care about me, you know. Eventually, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I came to stay for myself, but I originally went for them. And I went off to treatment, and I did my 28-day deal, and I got a little bit of an education. I had a little bit of a pink cloud there, and I played hopscotch and rolled down the hill with the other kids. And another were trying to teach us to learn to have fun again, and that was kind of fun, and that was a good experience for me. After I stopped trying to figure out who I was going to sleep with and stuff. because that's what we do, isn't it, ladies? You know, we scope it out. Who's a possibility? I did that in rehab. What they did was they gave me the same counselor that my husband had. So she had my number when I walked in the door. And I did that stuff for maybe 10 days. And then I really, something got a hold of me, and I really became interested in maybe actually changing my life. And so I stopped trying to look for who I was going to sleep around with, and I tried to listen and focus on what was going on there. And then eventually I went home. And so, I mean, I got a little bit of a rest, and I got a little bit of an education. But when I got home and I saw my apartment that I lived in, what it really looks like when I'm not totally plastered all the time, wow. It was a pretty crappy apartment to begin with, and it was totally crooked. And so everything kind of rolled under the stove, and it was so dirty. Oh, my God, it was so disgustingly dirty. And I had 14 bags of garbage on the back porch, and it was August. And so they were all full of maggots. And this was my mess to clean up, and I thought, well, you know what? This will be, you know, part of my amends for these kids is I got to give them a house that they're not going to get sick living in. And I got my husband's motorcycle gloves, the kind that come up to here, and I put them on, and I got rid of all that garbage, and the gloves went too. And I cleaned the apartment, and then I went and got drunk. Of course I did. I remember I went to my mom's house because I was going crazy. They had given me a phone number before I left, and they made me call this woman that was my AA contact back home. Before I left treatment to go home, they made me call her and make a plan to see her. But until that came, I was like really squirrely, and so I got in the car and I drove to my mother's house, and so the kids could go play in her yard. And I opened the freezer for ice, and there was this bottle of Absolut vodka sitting there, and it was all cold looking in the freezer, and it was just no thought. This is for me. No thought at all. And then I'm driving home from my mother's drunk with the 2-year-old and the 5-year-old in the car, as I always did. I was very fortunate. I still have a little pocket full of I nevers, never got caught drinking and driving. I did it all the time. I'm very fortunate. And then I drank again. I got and this was the insanity that got me to call this woman back and agree to go see her. I put my kids in the car. I needed a drink so bad. But my son, who was 5, is hip to the deal. You know, I was really fortunate to have friends and family that took turns hosting my children while they went to treatment. They spent a week here, a week there, a week there, and a week there. They had 4 host families that took care of them so that DIFAS was never called. My kids were well taken care of. They had a little calendar that they were Xing off the days until mommy comes home, and he was hip to the deal, and he didn't want to have to do that again. And so I remember getting in the car with them, putting the baby in the car seat and my son in his seatbelt, and driving up and down 31 until they would fall asleep, and hoping that they would fall asleep before the liquor store closed. And they did, and I got some alcohol, and I went home, and I put them in their little beds, and I cracked a beer, and then I just was like, oh, this sucks. And I got on the phone, and she told me to dump it all out. And I told her I did, but I didn't. I think I dumped one out. I was like, okay. You know, drank five, and I was like, oh, can you hear it? You know, I'm dumping it out. But that was my last drink, and I started to go to AA meetings, and I started to try to do something different with my life. And I was not one of those people that walked into AA and it was like, ah, I'm home, this is it. I hated it. I especially hated the women, which I know a lot of us feel that way too. And I've come to understand that I just assumed you were all like me, therefore, that ain't good. You know, can't be trusted, lie, steal, take your man. You know, that's what women were to me, because that's who I was. I didn't know that at the time. I just pointed the finger at all of you and said, I don't want to get to know any of you. And I was going to meetings in the richest county in the country with these women that went home from the meeting to their horses, and they had maids and McMansions, not all of them, but a lot of them. And I had a really hard time going in there saying, well, I'm on welfare and my car's not legal and I don't have a telephone. I had a $900 phone bill and I was supposed to be calling people and I didn't have a phone. So I used to take my kids, baby in the stroller, my son would hold my hand, we'd take our German Shepherd dog and we would go down to Hot Rod's Hot Dogs, Ann will know that one. They had a payphone. They had a payphone there, and that's how I called people in AA. Was down on the highway at Hot Rod's Hot Dogs with the kids and the dog. And I was in a lot of pain, and I was willing to try. And so I did it. I just kept showing up, even though I didn't like it, and I didn't like the women. But I just kept doing it. And I got a sponsor, and I had a couple of sponsors in succession. The first two, you know, I really didn't, it was a set of circumstances they couldn't sponsor me anymore. But the third one I got was still pretty early on, and she was a wonderful, loving person. But she wasn't in the solution. You know, it was go to meetings. You know, don't think, don't drink, go to meetings. Okay. Don't think, I don't know how to do that. Don't drink, I'm going to really try not to drink just for today, and I'm going to try to go to meetings. And I dragged those kids around with Lego blocks and coloring books, and people gave me dirty looks because they were loud, but I was trying to teach them to be quiet, because if I was going to get sober without, you know, as a single mom, I was going to have to teach my kids how to be quiet in a meeting, and I was doing that. And I was really struggling. I was really struggling because the solution, I didn't get it. I went to step meetings to try to learn how to work the steps. I had no clue. I would just get confused. I had no idea what was going on. Nobody told me the directions were in the big book. Now, maybe things were said. Obviously, they were said at some point in meetings. I can't be in a totally dysfunctional area, right? But I wasn't hearing it or whatever. I don't know. I didn't know the directions were in the book. I didn't know the step book was really just a collection of essays to kind of supplement, you know, that book. And so I would go to step meetings and try to figure out. Everything was in my head, you know. How am I going to do this step? I'll do everything in my head. I didn't know anything about action. I didn't know anything about work. And I was not relying on God. I had no problem with the first step. I had no problem admitting I was an alcoholic. I had no problem admitting my life was unmanageable. Clearly, I had a lot of wreckage that pointed to my unmanageability. What I didn't know at the time is that my life is unmanageable by me all the time. You know, I considered my unmanageability to be in the past when I was drinking. So that's kind of where I was at when I first got here with the first step. I didn't have any problem with the second step. I firmly believed that God was powerful and he could do whatever he wanted. I didn't believe he would. I didn't trust that he would for me. And so I struggled with that third step for a long time, and I do not recommend that. Man, I was such a pain in the ass. I was all that, you know, how we are sometimes with the, what about all the kids that are, you know, hurt so badly and all the terrible things that go on in the world and blah, 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 blah. And I was one of those. Everything was God's fault. Everything was God's doing. And I don't know why I felt that way. Because when I was younger, I went to Catholic church and I loved it. Loved it. I used to go even if my parents didn't go. I used to go to the Stations of the Cross on Friday night and confession on Wednesday so that I could take communion on Sunday. I loved it. But at some point, I decided that God is this terrible, punishing person not to be trusted with my life. And I had a really hard time with that. And it was only emotional pain that finally got me to try something different. Because I was going to meetings and I was talking to people. And I was 9 months before I got a home group. I walked into this group, and this lady got her hooks on me. And where's your home group? Well, I don't have one. Well, this is it, and this is your job. And so I remember we smoked at that time. I used to clean the ashtrays and show up and make the coffee with the coffee maker. I wasn't the coffee maker. I was the assistant coffee maker. And then I graduated to the coffee maker. And I remember after I was 2 years sober, they made me the treasurer. And I thought, I'm really going somewhere now, you know. I didn't realize I had just totally been demoted, you know. Because that's how it is in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. We think we're going up, but we're actually being demoted. And the greatest possible job and goal we can achieve is servant. And I didn't know that, though. I thought it was pretty cool. So I'm 2 years sober. I got the treasury for my home group. And I kind of gave lip service to God, but no way was I turning my life and will over. So obviously I haven't done any of the other steps. I'm still on step three. And I'm dying. I'm dying. I'm so unhappy. I'm so uncomfortable. What did I get sober for? This is terrible. And so at some point I really did start to listen, and I realized I think I'm supposed to be doing something. My sponsor, God bless her, didn't have me doing anything. And so I didn't fire her. I just went and found other people that were doing it. And I said, tell me how to do this. You know, I'm going to kill myself. This is terrible. And so I was fortunate to get a person in my life who told me, honey, it's all in the big book. Really? Okay, will you show me? And she did. She did. I got my husband to take the kids away for the weekend. We had gotten back together at some point, and we were trying really hard to stay out of each other's program. But I got him to take the kids away for the weekend, and she came over to our apartment, and we did the deal over the weekend. And we got in the book, and I did a really thorough fourth step. Then I did a fifth step with her, but then I called my sponsor, and I did a fifth step with her also. And it was okay. what changed everything for me, and I remember it very well, was when I finally truly surrendered. I mean, we talk about turning it over to God, and I would, you know, turn over my alcoholism and ask him to help me to stay sober and stuff like that. But I had no concept of God dependence, God reliance, none. And it was pain that brought me to the point of being willing to surrender, to be willing to give up all those arguments and all that crap and all my twisted thinking and all my warped ideas and just lay it all down. You know, to me, it almost feels like I was laying down my guns. You know, I had all this hardware, and I just dropped it all, and I got down on my knees, and I got down on my knees as much as I could. They call it the child pose in yoga, if anybody does yoga. I was all the way down, just in absolute surrender, and I changed. Something changed, and when I told you about what alcohol did for me, the gears that were off, and the psh, that's what happened again to me. Something clicked and was right again, you know, and Sandy talks about, you know, we're all just missing God, you know, we're all just missing God. And when I finally just recognized that and surrendered to God, I started to get well, and I started to do the work. I was really fortunate. My job paid for me to go to New York and stay in a hotel for the weekend with Joe and Charlie. Remember them? The original Joe and Charlie. What a gift. My job paid for everything. And that was an experience that really, I think, had a lot to do with me getting on the right track really learning about the steps and the action that needed to be taken in order for me to have a spiritual experience sufficient to recover from alcoholism. Oh, my God, is that what I'm supposed to be doing here? You know, it says right in the big book, that's what this book is about. You know, that's what this book is about. I didn't hear that. And so I was off, and I was starting to live my life differently, and things were getting better. You know, I had kind of this group of years where my husband's doing okay and I'm doing okay. We're making a lot of friends. We're doing the deal. You know, I was the GSR in my group. You know, I was doing some service stuff. I was going to to the assemblies and things of that nature, and he was doing some stuff, and he was going into the jail, and I was going into the jail, and the kids were thriving. Things were pretty good for a long time, you know. I mean, I don't know that we were complacent, but I think that, I don't know what it was. We had a good little nice life for quite a while there. And he was sick periodically on and off, which was kind of difficult at times, but we had a pretty nice life. And then, you know, something happened. I try not to take his inventory. I really do. But I believe that he became spiritually sick again. I believe he started to rest on his laurels and not practice the spiritual principles that keep us. I mean, I firmly believe that God brought me to AA so that AA could bring me to God. That's what the whole plan was. And he stopped doing a lot of things that he had been doing. Meditation and prayer and helping others. I could see him kind of getting selfish, and I said something to him. You know, for a long time, we stayed out of each other's program, stayed out of each other's business, and I think that was really important. But I did start to say something to him. I was worried about him because I knew he wasn't doing what he needed to do to stay sober, you know. Trust God, clean house, help others. He wasn't doing a lot of those things. And he got a new job. He was going to be in federal law enforcement that he was really excited about, and he was pretty pumped up about it, and he went off to the academy down in Georgia. He was going to be gone for a couple of months, and so I can do this. I can hold down the fort, you know. I got my sponsees and my friends, and I'm working the program, doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm doing it. We can do this. We can get through this. We didn't have a whole lot of money. He had been out of work for a while, so this was a real kind of boon to the family that he got this new job, and things were going to start getting better again financially. So he's down in Georgia, and so I guess we're both about 15 years sober now, and I know things aren't real good in the marriage, and I don't really know what to do about it, but I come to find out that he was having another affair. Oh, you know, when we got sober, we had to recognize that we were both not acting like married people. We had to chalk it up to alcoholism, dysfunction, unmanageability. We had to forgive each other. We did a lot of work around it. With our sponsors, with other professionals that helped us to stay together, and we got past that, and now we're 15 years sober, and here we are again, and I was devastated. It was a woman in AA. Oh, twist the knife, you know. Somebody I know, you know. There were women in the program that I loved and trusted that knew and didn't tell me. It was really awful, and it was had the real potential to divide our recovering community. And I really didn't want that to happen, but I also didn't want to see any of those people anyway. So I started going to other meetings and stuff. Now, he's still down in Georgia. I can't even afford to go visit him, and she's going down there all the time. Oh, my God, I was so hurt. And when I think about that time, I was just hurt. I was just hurt. You know, people were looking for the anger. It wasn't there yet. It came later. But I was just so devastatingly hurt, and I didn't know what to do. And one of my failings was I let my sponsees go. Sober fail. And I had to make amends to them for that. I was such a freaking basket case, though. I mean, I was going to work. I was going to meetings. I was calling people. I was talking to God all the time. I decided, well, I can't live in this house, so I might as well start fixing it up. So I started fixing it up, and, you know, I redid walls, and I removed carpet, and I remember I spent like a week pulling nails out of the floor and talking to God. My sponsor hadn't moved to Florida yet, so I was spending a lot of time with her. She made me do an inventory on the marriage. She made me write him a letter. And I was able to do that. I did a complete inventory on that relationship. We went down to the river and we prayed and we burned it, and I felt a lot better. I slept about 4 hours a night. I didn't eat very much. And I talked to God almost constantly. And my friends, you know, when I really was jumping out of my skin, I was on my friend Kathy's patio, just crying and drinking coffee and smoking my cigarettes, and they were holding me up and they were keeping me going. And I got close to God in a way I had never known before. It really was a gift out of that diversity. So he came back and broke up with her and wanted to get back with me, and I knew I couldn't do it. We'd been through too much. I wasn't going to do this again. I couldn't. We're 15 years sober. I can't trust that this is not going to happen again. He never drank. He never picked up. He just, you know, filled that hole with something else. And I didn't have a whole lot of confidence in it. So I was like, no, you know, we're going to get divorced and we're going to sell the house and it'll be okay and blah, blah, blah. And so that was December that he came back, broke up with her, got his own apartment. And like 2 weeks later, he was diagnosed with liver cancer and given 6 months to live. I was like, oh my God, you know. But I had done that inventory. And I had worked through a lot of that stuff. And I had hope again. And I was living again. I was feeling a lot better. I was closer to God than ever. I was starting to sleep a little more. I was doing a little better. And he wanted to come home. And he wanted to give up his apartment and come home. And he wanted to die there. And he did. And I was able to do that. And people, you know, this was not me. This was not me. This was God working in my life. I had picked up sponsees again, of course, because that really is the key to all this mess, isn't it? Helping others, getting out of self. And the more I had a rock down by the river. I had a little stream that ran through my yard, and I went down there every day for my morning prayer and meditation, and I surrendered, and it became clear to me that I needed to get sponsees back in my life if I was going to have any happiness at all. And so, and people started coming to me. It was like, people started coming and asking me, and I always try to say yes to AA, and so I started to get some sponsees, and they saved my life, you know, my friends and you guys, you all saved my life, and I had a house full of people all the time. The men from AA brought meetings in to him when he couldn't leave anymore, and I had guys cutting my grass, I had women cleaning my house, I had people picking me up and taking me places and holding me up and keeping us going, and we never could have gotten through any of this without AA and the people in it and God. I believe he found his higher power again at the end there, and I hope that he has some peace. We had a sober priest in the program, a friend of ours that was helping him out with that, and he died peacefully one morning in the house, and I was with him, and I was blessed to be there, honestly, truthfully blessed to be there and see him go. The night before, I was sitting and the priest was coming the next day to give him his last rites. And I knew the priest was coming the next day, and it was at the end. We knew it was at the end. And I remember I had some candles lit and some meditation music on, and I was reading prayers to him. And he was kind of out of it. And then he woke up, and there were a lot of blessings for me in that time in my life. But he was pointing at people behind me. And I felt, I had chills, I felt presence in the room. I mean, I really felt like they were coming for him. You know, we knew it was the end and they were coming for him. And I didn't think he'd make it to the last rites, so I did it. Little layman's last rites there, but I had the prayers and I blessed him and I did it. And then the following morning he passed. He didn't get to see the priest, so I'm grateful for that. That was 3 years ago. My whole life changed again, you know, obviously. But it's been great, you know. I've been able to embrace it and just go with it and not question it. And you guys taught me that. You guys helped me get to God so that I would know that it was all going to be okay. The sponsees that I have, oh, my God, they're so great. I have this one girl that I've been sponsoring for 4 years, and she's been in and out. And about 7 months ago, the light went on, and I was sitting right there. And, oh, my God, we have had the most wonderful experiences every week going through the book. And it's been such a gift to have. Isn't it a gift to have front seat to other people's recovery? Oh, my goodness. And now she has two sponsees that she's taken through the book. And it's amazing. It's amazing. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful. I have so many gifts in my life. And I have a really cool boyfriend. That's kind of fun, you know. At some point, I mean, I had been with my husband since I was 19 years old, and all I did was drink until 27, got sober, blah, blah, blah. So I was like, wow, I could, like, date. This could be fun. Oh, my God, what if I have no idea how to date in sobriety. I went to some single people and I asked them. They didn't know either. Man, just, you know, wait until you've worked all the 12 steps before you do it. But, I mean, it's going to be a little messy no matter what, right? We've been through a lot in three years, too, that we've been together. I think I was with him pretty quick after my husband passed away. But I was ready. I had processed so much stuff. I was ready, you know, to let go. But anyway, another interesting thing happened was he started going to a spiritual decline, this guy that I'm dating now. I'd seen this already. I know this one. And I was, like, really struggling with it. And I finally just made the decision to break up with him. And I was getting ready to have major surgery, and he was supposed to help me through it. But I was like, I broke up with him, but he kind of wasn't going away. And so I was out on the Delaware River at my mother's house by myself, major surgery. I'm not allowed to get out of bed. He's the only person there to take care of me. He goes out and doesn't come back. Shoot. He texted me that he picked up. I'm like, what? You know, now don't we just have the way of doing things at the total wrong time? So, I got a million women that I can call, and I made some calls, and they were there, and they helped me, and they took care of me so that I could get well. But he went off to treatment, and then when he came back, Jimmy C sponsored him. I owe a lot to Jimmy C, let me tell you, because he had been sober, 10 years in this program when he picked up. He wasn't doing the deal. And Jimmy said, dude, you want to do the deal? We'll do it. And he did it with him. And now I get to see not only my guy have a total spiritual experience, but now he's taking other guys through the books, and some of his guys are taking other guys through the book. It's just been such a joy. It's been a really wild 3 years. And we're all, you know, in Bloomsbury on Friday night, so come check us out. My digital clock here says 9 o'clock, so it's time for me to shut up. I really appreciate you listening to me. I am so grateful to be sober today, and I thank you.